From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Happy Friday, everyone. On today's show, how did an ad that attacks Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez air during last night's Democratic debate? And the New York Times TV critic argues that Donald Trump is essentially playing a character that he created for television.
You're the star of this TV show that's on 24 hours a day. It's called The News, and the president is always the main character in it. And it's about you, and it's about what you're fighting with. You know, why would you ever watch anything else?
And the TV series This Close breaks new ground depicting deaf characters. All that coming up on The Frame. It's Friday, yeah, and that means it's time for our end-of-the-week conversation with our friends at Variety. Today, we're joined by Brian Steinberg. He covers the business of advertising, media, and television at Variety. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing, John?
I am well. Let's talk about the controversy over an ad that ran during last night's Democratic candidate debate. Tell us what that ad was about.
Yeah, this is a spot that showed New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a basically burning on camera. It's a very dark and noticeable thing to do, and probably not the norm.
This is the face of socialism and ignorance. Does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez know the horror of socialism? My father was minutes from death in Cambodia before a forced marriage saved his life. That's socialism. Forced obedience, starvation.
It was by somebody named Elizabeth Heng, and it was through a political action committee. What do we know about Elizabeth Heng and the political action committee that put the ad together?
We know she's a Republican activist. I believe she's also a former congressional candidate who did not win when she did run. So she did that. And I think now she's a member of this PAC. So she's definitely a political operative.
Some people are calling for a boycott of ABC, but it's unclear to me if the ad ran on the network or stations owned by the Sinclair Broadcast Group. Do you know where it ran and who ran it?
We're not quite clear on that. My guess, just an educated guess, most political advertisers are, and this one is quite, my guess is probably medium size or small size, probably could not afford a national ad buy on ABC in prime time. The strategy probably would be to run the ad in certain markets that have the people they're trying to reach most intently. My educated guess would say that they probably bought stations in certain markets where they were trying to make a point. That could be big cities as well as small towns.
Well, it definitely appears to have run in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people are now watching the ad online. So it may not have been something that was approved by ABC, but in rough terms, what does a network have to say about what ads are and are not on its airwaves?
Networks for these type of things typically, I think, try to not run ads that require them to give equal voice to other parties. You know, that means they would have to run, you know, commercials ad infinitum for political things. There are mistakes, and there have been in the past, where they run certain commercials that are just so political that they require an opposing viewpoint almost immediately, or you know, the claims can't be verified immediately. But they're supposed to kind of vet most commercials for competitive claims, and that sort of thing. And so I would be suspicious that ABC ran this nationwide.
I think it's important to note what the Sinclair Broadcast Group is, because they are also not only an owner of almost 200 stations across the country, but they appear to have a political agenda and have been asking some of their news anchors to run political pieces that basically echo some talking points out of the Trump White House. So who is Sinclair and why are they an important part of this story?
Well, Sinclair is a massively large owner of stations. They own stations that are affiliates of ABC and others. They have been known to set a conservative agenda. In recent years, they've been trying to build up their own news gathering and news programming across the nation. And they've also mandated in certain instances for their various local news programs to take up certain topics or broadcast certain editorials from people who are hired by Sinclair, without always disclosing that the station ownership or the company ownership has certain political stances.
Is there anything that people could ask either Sinclair or ABC to do in terms of response? Does the equal time idea still apply?
Well, when politicians get on, they you know, the network is typically mandated to, you know, provide access to someone of the opposing thing. And that's why they typically avoid, they're very kind of strict about these political commercials. I think, you know, this happened on NBC when they ran an ad showing, you know, people swarming a wall during the kind of height of the immigration controversy. And it ran during Sunday Night Football, one of the biggest shows on the schedule. Everyone saw it, and NBC actually came out with a statement saying it should not have run. It was an error on our part that the ad ran. So networks are cognizant of these things, and they usually watch a little more closely, which is why we have to get to the bottom whether it was a national, ran nationally or ran station by station, where the networks often are surprised to find out what some of the stations are putting on the air.
It seems like a massive reach to compare Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Pol Pot or the Khmer Rouge. But do the people who put this ad together have the freedom to suggest that, even if it's not essentially factually true?
You're supposed to make verifiable claims. Now, as for products, politics can kind of range farther afield. You see all kinds of, you know, claims and things. And one reason that this is allowed to kind of flourish is the majority of political advertising takes place on the local ad sphere, not national. National is, A, far too expensive for most people to afford running on a regular basis, and B, you know, not very targeted. If you're running for Senate in St. Louis, there's often little reason for you to run an ad in New York City. If you're a national candidate, you know, for president, you can probably target the markets that are most up for grabs, most of them are battleground states, which is why, like, Ohio and Florida every 4 years win just an amazing amount of political advertising. I understand when I talk to people in the past, sometimes local stations can't take it. They're so full of capacity of commercials, they can't turn things away. This is a big business. It's millions of dollars, but it typically flourishes in local stations rather than national advertising until the very, very end when you're down to two candidates for a presidential election.
So essentially, you can't run an advertisement that says eating a Big Mac is going to lower your cholesterol and make you a healthier person, but you might be able to run an ad comparing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Pol Pot.
McDonald's is going to have a harder time than a political action group. That sounds correct, yes.
Brian Steinberg is the senior TV editor at Variety. Brian, thanks for coming on the show. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks so much, John.
You can keep up with all the latest entertainment industry news at Variety.com. Coming up on The Frame, a prominent TV critic argues that the best way to think of Donald Trump is as a TV character. By now, it's true, and not really partisan, to say that Donald Trump loves television. He tweets regularly about what he's watching, Fox News, not CNN, and he uses the language of TV currency, that is, ratings, to refer to his own success. But James Poniewozik, the chief TV critic for The New York Times, doesn't actually see Trump just as a fan of television. In many ways, Poniewozik writes that he's a construct of the medium. His new book is called Audience of One, Donald Trump Television and the Fracturing of America. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk about a TV reality show, not Apprentice, but a show called Survivor, and about the winner of the first year, Richard Hatch.
I don't think somebody's in control of our group in particular. I think I'm in control of who's being voted off. And I think that's all that matters to me.
God, I'm glad I'm on your team.
Yeah, baby.
Richard Hatch succeeded as being an anti-hero, and people liked him. You write of Hatch, he realized that the only rules were that there were no rules. He lied and backstabbed and took advantage of loopholes, and he argued with a telegenic brashness that this made him smart. So how do you draw the connection between Richard Hatch and Donald Trump, setting aside for a fact that The Apprentice and Survivor were both produced by Mark Burnett?
Richard Hatch's arc in winning the first season of Survivor is basically Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. You know, he won a vote by arguing to his audience that he was a bad guy, maybe, but he deserved it. He outplayed them. He outlasted them. And even if you didn't like him, even if you didn't like his methods, you know, you had to admire how well he did it. And that was very much a part of Donald Trump's argument for himself at every debate.
Oh, you didn't delete him?
Allow her to respond, please.
Personal emails, not official.
33,000?
Yeah. Well, we turned over 35,000. So it was.
What about the other 15,000?
Please allow her to respond. She didn't talk while you talked.
Yes, that's true. I didn't.
Because I didn't in the
first debate, and I'm going to try not to in this debate.
We are a culture now that is comfortable with the idea of rooting for the anti-hero, of rooting for this sort of charismatic breaker of norms who makes a compelling argument that, you know, you can kind of morally compartmentalize and say, yeah, okay, maybe I wouldn't want this guy as a model for my kids, but it's an ugly world full of ugly competition. And, you know, sometimes you got to break some eggs to win.
I want to play a clip now from The Apprentice.
The problem is that Bradford made a stupid, impulsive, life-threatening decision that, frankly, if you were running a company and made that kind of a decision, you destroy that company instantaneously. Bradford, you're fired.
The author and comedian Fran Lebowitz said of Trump that he is, quote, a poor person's idea of a rich person. And I'm wondering how that assessment falls into what happened in The Apprentice and how Trump was cast and depicted, because he wasn't necessarily the thing that the show presented him to be.
Fran Lebowitz's great quote might be meant as an insult, but it also explains why he was perfect for reality TV. Because what reality TV needs is not the thing itself. It needs the cartoon of the thing, right? You know, the Survivor is a shut-in's idea of survival in nature. The Bachelor is a lonely person's idea of romance. And on The Apprentice, when Mark Burnett is creating this show, he doesn't need a hugely successful businessman. He needs the symbol of a successful businessman. He needs the idea of business. And what Donald Trump had been doing for, you know, decades at that point was basically producing himself as a personal reality TV show. You know, in other words, he's surrounding himself with all of these signifiers of wealth and success, you know, a tower in Manhattan with his name on it in 3 feet tall brass letters, a jet and a helicopter with his name on it, all of these images of gold and luxury overload, all of these things getting into the popular media and the popular consciousness that, you know, when you just sort of close your eyes and imagine what is my picture of a rich guy, Donald Trump comes to mind.
Right. And he is depicted as incredibly successful at a time when he is teetering on bankruptcy.
Yeah. You know, one thing that happened with Donald Trump was that at the end of the 80s, his businesses crash and he runs into these bankruptcies. And literally the sort of fictional character of Donald Trump has to bail out the real businessman Donald Trump, because he has to keep his brand alive for his creditors and the people who took over his businesses and needed to keep a value in them. And that meant that he had to keep up the appearance. And he starts playing himself as this sort of self-parodic character who, you know, will go anywhere that there's a TV camera and does, you know, cameos on The Fresh Prince.
Ron said his client had a rich uncle, but Donald Trump.
I like keeping a low profile.
And that sort of builds this media brand that he's able to leverage into success in The Apprentice. Whether or not the bottom line of his actual business is impressive doesn't matter if you can build an impressive appearance within the four walls of a TV studio.
We're talking with James Poniewozik about his book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. So if Donald Trump kind of creates himself as this TV character and he runs for president as this kind of hyper reality show, then what is the White House? How does that fit into the narrative of how television is the definition and the world in which Donald Trump exists?
One thing you can see after Donald Trump becomes president is that he used television in many ways to get elected. But once he's president, TV in many ways controls him, because he is not only a TV personality, he is a voracious TV consumer. He is somebody who has always, as you know, a self-created celebrity, been very concerned, obsessively concerned, with getting into the media and knowing what the media is saying about him. Back in his 80s days, reportedly, he had staff at Trump Tower who would keep a file of VCR tapes of his appearances that he would watch as, you know, sort of a form of ego maintenance. You know, so now you're president and you're the star of this TV show that's on 24 hours a day. It's called The News, and the president is always the main character in it. And it's about you, and it's about what people are saying about you and what you did and whether you're up or you're down and who you made mad and who you're fighting with. You know, why would you ever watch anything else? And in fact, it often seems that that's the main thing that he does. And it drives his agenda. It drives the news agenda. It controls the world that we're living in, because he's getting up in the morning and watching Fox and Friends or watching news shows on TiVo, getting mad about them, tweeting about them.
Donald Trump tweeted that he is ordering, he said, U.S. companies to find an alternative to doing business in China. He said
progressive congresswomen critical of his immigration policies should go back to the countries they originally came from.
Okay, so he sent the Alabama tweet out saying Alabama was at risk along with Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina.
Cough of Fifi. Can you explain this one for us, Corey?
It creates this sort of feedback loop of just intensifying, constantly building conflict that is just basically the metabolism of the reality that we live now.
If Donald Trump is, in some ways, the Donald Trump show, like other TV series, if we all stopped watching and talking about it, like any other TV show, would the Trump show featuring Donald Trump get canceled?
Well, you know, here is an interesting thing, because, you know, a big question right now is whether 3 years into Trump's presidency, you're seeing a kind of just exhaustion, irrespective of people's individual politics. If, you know, people are just tired of, you know, constantly being agitated by what's coming across their phones or what's in the news and whether they want to break from it. Interestingly, one can see a bit of a parallel with this in the history of The Apprentice. The Apprentice was a huge sensation its first season on the air, and Donald Trump was its breakout star. And what NBC and The Apprentice and Donald Trump did is what you often do in television, which is if something is working, you give people five times as much of it, right? So they heavily scheduled The Apprentice, and Donald Trump starts playing a more, you know, kind of in-your-face, exaggerated version of this "you're fired" guy character that he created on there, and people start to burn out on it. The ratings drop pretty quickly. And on the one hand, the show stays on the air for 14 seasons with Donald Trump. But on the other hand, it's never the number one thing on television again. Now, in television, you can, you know, lose your time slot to Mike and Molly and finish third, but still be profitable enough that you stay on the air. In an election, you finish third, you lost the election. So, you know, I do think that while getting a lot of attention has, you know, always been a lot of benefit to Donald Trump as a TV figure and a TV performance, he's also susceptible to the danger of overexposure and burnout.
James Poniewozik is the chief TV critic for The New York Times. His new book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. James, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up next on The Frame, a new TV series called This Close stars and was created by two deaf actors. This Close is a dramedy on the Sundance Channel. It's about two best friends navigating life and love in Los Angeles. That may sound pretty familiar, maybe even generic, but this show is actually the first of its kind, a TV series starring, created, and written by deaf people. Josh Feldman and Shoshana Stern are the creators and stars of This Close. Frame contributor Ari Saperstein has their story.
If there's one thing Shoshana Stern and Josh Feldman want viewers to take away from watching their show, it's this.
There are all kinds of deaf people in the world. deaf people can be assholes too.
Typically, deaf characters are these amazing people or they're role models. And, you know, with our show, we really want to make sure that Kate and Michael would not be mistaken as role models. Like, they're just two normal young adults just trying to do their best.
I first meet Stern and Feldman when they're doing a photo shoot for the LA Times ahead of the season 2 premiere of This Close. They've come so far. In just a few short years, they went from a low-budget web series to a critically acclaimed show on the Sundance Channel. Working with a photographer who doesn't know sign language proves no problem at all, in part because Feldman and Stern have interpreters who translate for them. In fact, those are the voices you're hearing throughout this interview. The interpreters are hired by the studio, but Stern says other employers have not been willing to do the same.
People feel like, why do we have to shoulder that burden? Why don't you just bring someone with you who can interpret for you? That's what I often get. You know, I would love to, but that means that then I have to ask my friends for a favor, or then I have to pay out of my own pocket as well. I know it's not my responsibility as a deaf person to have to provide accessibility for them. At the same time, I also know that they can't see the value in providing accessibility for me yet. So I'm hoping by us hiring deaf people that people can see the value in it.
That includes, you know, casting people for in front of the camera work, hiring people to work behind the camera as well. How many deaf people did we have working altogether, did you say?
Around 25.
Yeah, about 25 people. So that included actors, photographers, hair and makeup people, editors.
Art department.
We've set a lot of new precedences with our show.
One of those precedents is Feldman and Stern's commitment to depicting authentic experiences of deaf people on screen. And not just visually, but also through sound.
I think most hearing people assume for deaf people that sound is binary and that it's an all or nothing kind of relationship. So with our show, the different kinds of deaf people that we have on screen and their different relationships with sound is definitely fun to portray. And it's fun to think about.
The sound design in This Close shows the spectrum of deafness. One standout scene features a group of both hearing and deaf characters having a conversation.
We had Millie, who has a cochlear implant in real life, and her character also was written to have a cochlear implant. We enter into this character sound perspective.
Blythe, this Russian tea is just too good. It's a holiday staple in there.
And then we had Kate, and she has to be dependent on her hearing aids. And then Kate's granny, who was losing her hearing.
She's fine, but when she hit that kitchen floor, you would have
thought that the Lord was returning.
You know, sitting with a sound guy, I had to explain what that would really sound like to really show how different it is for each of these three women. Going into the sound booth for that and providing notes on sound. As a deaf person, I never thought that I would be giving notes on what the sound is.
As a show that frequently uses two languages, English and American Sign Language, the creators want to ensure that it's accessible to all audiences at all times.
Every time our characters sign, there will be subtitles on the screen. And when the characters speak, you'll have closed captioning. So nobody's going to miss out on anything. And that was really important to us as deaf people because oftentimes we miss out on things, whether it be just like the captioning goes haywire or the show is not closed captioned to begin with. You know, we've all experienced that as deaf people. So like we wanted to be very careful to make sure that our show was 100% accessible.
Even coming up with the title, This Close, was a process of bridging the divide between the hearing world of the network and the deaf world of the show.
We've gone back and forth with the network, back and forth, back and forth. And all of it was like English words that they were trying to use to capture the deaf experience, like the sound of silence. Deaf like me. But I said, I think we're actually working backwards. I said, I really think that instead of trying to find an English word to capture the deaf experience, we should be thinking of a sign. Because that's the language of the community that we're trying to portray. So we should think of a sign and then find a translation into English from the sign.
And with that, Shoshana held up her hand to show me the sign for This Close.
So you would have your index finger and your middle finger crossing. So we're showing that something that's intertwined by having our fingers literally intertwined. And so that's also a sign used for best friends.
The show is about growing up. And so you often feel this close to something, but you're not quite there yet.
Now, this is Feldman and Stern's first time on the radio, so I decided to end the interview by asking them about the elephant in the room.
does it feel weird to participate in something that isn't very accessible to deaf people?
Well, in a way, it's a little weird, right? Because we would never really know what the final product actually sounds like. So yes, it is a little strange, but as long as we get more people to listen to our story, then so be it.
Shoshana Stern and Josh Feldman are the stars and creators of the Sundance TV show This Close. Special thanks to interpreters Robbie Sutton and Samantha Garley. For The Frame, I'm Ari Saperstein.
New episodes of This Close air Thursday nights on the Sundance Channel. And that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova, with help this week from Itzi Quintanilla. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentina Rivera is the show's engineer. The opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. Make sure to tune in for The Frame Weekend, which airs Saturday at 2 p.m., We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.